Welcome to the Senate Education and General Government Committee. First, to my fellow committee members, thank you for persevering through Friday in my absence. You did a great job. The reviews are in.
They probably haven't told you about all the bills we passed.
Excuse my tardiness.
I also wanted to say that Senate Bill 901 will be carried over to Wednesday. And we're going to begin today with a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 748. We have a panel of people led by Senator Mona Sanderson, Joe Gall, Jim Kite, Chris Crane. Did you guys all want to come up at the same time? Would that make sense?
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 748 permits a county governing body to dissolve a tax supervising and conservation commission under certain circumstances, and it provides for the transfer of the dissolved commission's unexpended funds. We do have a fiscal and revenue statement on this measure.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Senator Lori Mona Sanderson. I represent Gresham Troutdale Wood Village in Fairview. I'm delighted to be here and so glad that you are considering Senate Bill 748. You know that we always are looking at ways for streamlining government, getting rid of things that we don't want, and here's a bill that would allow a county to dissolve a tax supervising and conservation commission, and that's exactly what this would do. I will turn it over to the people who know a whole lot more about it than I do, since I need to be in next door in a committee voting on some bills. So with that, I'd like to thank you.
Vote no.
Well, yeah, right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mayor?
Yes, Mayor Jim Kite of Troutdale. I'd like to speak in support of Senate Bill 748. And on Tuesday, April 14th, this year, the Troutdale City Council unanimously passed a resolution in support of Senate Bill 748. The City of Troutdale supports Senate Bill 748 for the following reasons. The purpose of the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission is not currently needed under state and local budget law. The structure of ORS 294.608, which gives the TSCC its authority, is law that was written back in 1919. With the first commission organized in 1921. Governance has changed since the era of Oregon history, and such changes include the restructure of Oregon budget law, requirements of local jurisdictions to hold public meetings with members of the public serving on our budget committees. In fact, that's happening tonight in Troutdale. The requirements for independent auditors to examine the financial documents of each jurisdiction. And even with the changes in the public contracting laws, we make our public finances very, very transparent. There is a requirement to have public meetings with a budget committee, which is made up of local residents and the city council members, and then there is a separate city council meeting to adopt the budget. There is a copy of the budget in the lobby of the city hall for the public to view, and there is a copy of our budget on our website. The city of Troutdale, like many other jurisdictions, have created finance or audit committees to have more understanding of the day-to-day financial operations of the jurisdictions they represent. The TSCC holds a public meeting on our budget in Portland. What service does that provide for our residents? Neither the city council, the budget committee members, nor our staff attends that meeting. The Troutdale City Council nor the budget committee members were not even aware of the meeting. The TSCC requires our staff to prepare a budget that fits their format, which is not the same format that the City of Troutdale uses. So all budgets within the jurisdiction of the TSCC have the same format and look the same. This is a lot of extra work for a staff that is not needed and is frankly quite redundant. We don't support the idea of having to pay for a portion of the TSCC, since our residents are already supporting the funding of TSCC through their property taxes. If Senate Bill 740 is passed, the City of Troutdale will ask Multnomah County Commissioners to eliminate the TSCC. In summary, I would like to say that the purpose of the TSC has run its course and, frankly, is no longer needed. The intent of the TSCC is now being met with more current state and local budget laws and has outgrown the laws that were created in the early part of the 20th century. Moreover, we would like to be treated like the rest of the counties in the state of Oregon and we have a great deal more options to educate the public now in the 21st century. We understand that there are some smaller organizations in Multnomah County that rely on the TSCC. However, they can use the expert resources at the Oregon State Department of Revenue, like all the other small taxing districts do throughout the state of Oregon. These other taxing districts are meeting their state requirements without having a TSCC in place in their county. And finally, we would encourage your support on this bill. We are partnering with the City of Fairview on this bill because the City of Troutdale believes it is the right step to start right-sizing government. I'd like to thank the committee for taking the time to hear this important issue and for allowing me time to speak and support a Senate bill on behalf of the City of Troutdale. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Mayor David Fuller from Wood Village, and our council likewise on April 14th passed a resolution in supporting this bill that was initiated by Fairview. I think Mayor Kite has given you a lot of the reasons. We might come at this from a little bit different direction. First of all, TSCC, the people there, I think, have done a good job. They've tried to support the cities and been very willing to help. However, they want to pass the cost of this service onto the cities. And since we believe it to be a redundant service that the state can provide as well, that if it's going to add to our budget costs in these hard times, that we would prefer that it go away if it's no longer needed. And so we support what they're doing, and we also know that the Fairview is in a lot of financial difficulties right now, as are all jurisdictions. And perhaps if this were to be eliminated, maybe that money could be used in areas that of greater concern. So I would ask the committee to support this bill, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, Senators. My name is Joe Gall. I'm the City Administrator for the City of Fairview. I'm actually here on behalf of my mayor, Mayor Mike Weatherby, who could not make this committee hearing, so I'm going to read his testimony very quickly. I apologize that I am unable to attend the hearing today on Senate Bill 748 in person, but I am still recovering from some recent surgery. As the committee members are aware, this bill is sponsored by our state senator, Lori Montes Anderson, on behalf of the City of Fairview. We requested that this legislation be crafted to help our Multnomah County Board of County Commissioners in an upcoming decision that we and other taxing districts within our county will be pursuing, and that is the dissolving of the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. These are difficult financial times for all levels of government, but one benefit that we are gaining is that we are forced to ask some very simple but important questions. Questions such as, is this still necessary, or is there a different way of doing this? These are the type of questions that we asked ourselves when we started to look closely at the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. Is this commission created in the early 20th century still necessary today in the early 21st century? Obviously, you can probably guess that it is our strong belief that the 39 different taxing districts within our county will be able to survive just fine without the services of the TSCC in the future. In fact, we will be joining the taxing districts in the other 35 counties in Oregon that do not have a TSCC. Some have already argued that without the TSCC watching over our districts, financial mistakes and errors will suddenly arise within our jurisdictions and agencies. I would argue that if the TSCC was serving effectively in such a watchdog role, why did they not uncover the financial issues related to our own Reynolds School District budget? I want to stress that while our position that this commission is outdated and unnecessary today, it has nothing to do with the fine professional staff that currently serves the commission. We believe that in tight fiscal times like now, the approximate $200,000 in savings for Multnomah County upon dissolving of this commission would be better used in retaining a sheriff's deputy position or continuing a son's school program at one of our schools. Thank you for your time and support in helping to make this happen in the future by passing Senate Bill 748. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the total budget for the TSCC?
Well, the executive director is here. It's maxed at $280,000 a year in the legislature, in the legislation. So that's about what they use each year. And right now it's fully funded by Multnomah County.
I'm not clear. For Fairview, your share is $200,000?
No, actually, Fairview, none of the 39 taxing districts currently pay for TSCC. It's fully funded by Multnomah County. The county has the responsibility of funding it. There is an adjacent House bill right now that the TSCC has sponsored that would spread that cost across all 39 taxing districts. So I think that's what Mayor Fuller was talking about. There could be a change in the future where the jurisdictions like ours would have to pay a small percentage of the cost for the TSCC.
Okay. But for now, that's the cost.
Right now, it's the county.
Right.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Except for the fact that it does cost you to create the report. So
yeah.
there is an expense to each taxing district embedded in this.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring up Tom Lynn Harris from Multnomah County.
Tom. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. On behalf of the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission, I appreciate this time to speak to Senate Bill 748. My name is Tom Lynn Harris, and I'm the Executive Director of the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission in Multnomah County. The Commission is opposed to Senate Bill 748 for three primary reasons. The first is that it gives the county unilateral decision to dissolve TSCC. We are an independent commission, five citizen volunteers appointed by the governor. And one of the reasons for that independence is that one of the jurisdictions we oversee is the county. I can't think of any other situation where an entity that is subject to regulation has the authority to dissolve its regulator. There would be nothing to prevent the county from moving ahead with dissolving TSCC, either in retaliation for or in anticipation of an adverse ruling by the commission. The Oregonian, in an editorial dated March 25, 2006, which I have attached to my testimony, appreciates the oversight responsibilities of TSCC as it relates to Multnomah County. The second reason is that the bill, as currently written, does not provide any sort of discussions between the county and the other 38 taxing districts that we serve. It would be the county's decision alone. There would be no requirement to notify the other districts or to consult with them or to even get their approval. Most of the districts in the county, and there are 39 of them again, value the services that we provide, and I would guess that most of them would not want to see the Tax Supervising Conservation Commission be dissolved. The third reason is that there is no timetable in the bill for dissolving the commission. Theoretically, the commission could decide on Friday and we could be out of business on Monday. That would be, again, there's no consultation with the taxing district, so that would catch the taxing districts by surprise. There is a slightly different process, particularly for large districts, and large is defined in statute as population over 200,000, for adjusting to the fact that there would be no commission. If the county decided in March, for example, to dissolve the commission, one of the things that would happen is that those large districts would have to appoint citizen members to the budget committee. That would be extremely difficult for them to do, given that short time frame for that year's budget review season. If we were right in the middle of producing our annual report, which runs about 250 pages, that's used by policymakers and citizens alike, we wouldn't have the chance to finish that. It is true we've been in business for 88 years, and in that time we've developed one heck of a lot of permanent records. Having no time frame does not give us the time to properly archive those records. So for those three reasons, the county shouldn't have unilateral decision to dissolve the commission. There's no method in place for consulting or getting the approval of the other taxing jurisdictions that we oversee, and the fact that there's no time frame established in the bill, we would be opposed to Senate Bill 748. And I appreciate your time and would be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Tom, on the timeline of the bill, first of all, the bill takes effect January 1st of next year. That's the first part. So I guess that would be the soonest that the commission can meet to do that. The commission, if making a decision on that, of course, is a public process as well, and accountability for making those types of decisions. And frankly, I haven't talked to any of the commissioners, so I don't know where they are on this, but I know everybody likes to have control of things themselves for various reasons, some historical or for other reasons. But understanding your opposition to the bill, and could I add just one other question, though, to it? If the bill were to go forward, and even if you oppose that, would you think it would be more helpful then, based on your testimony, that any decision would have to be delayed sometime beyond this January 1st, 2010, to allow for those types of processes and records adjustments that you have mentioned in your testimony?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, the short answer is yes. Depending on the time of the year, would depend on how much time we would need. Quite honestly, sometime between the January-March timeframe would probably be the best, because that way we've completed our annual report for the year, and it'd be a shame to waste all that effort and not produce our last annual report. We've been doing it, you know, every year for 88 years. And then that still would give the taxing districts a time to adjust somewhat to the process of not having a tax supervising conservation commission. Late March might be a little problematic for those districts who would for the first time have to go out and find citizen members of their budget committee, so the sooner the better. The short answer is yes. I don't know if my fuller answer satisfies all your questions and concerns, Senator?
Well, I think I understand that, Mr. Chair, in terms of providing your report, but you also mentioned about the voluminous records that you would keep and that would have to be turned over to other jurisdictions or the county or whatever. I was just trying to get an idea of how long of a process you think would be prudent to allow that transition of these historical records.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's a good question. I guess we would have to go through a process of deciding which ones would go down to the state archivist and which ones would be transferred to the county. I'm thinking 30 days.
Okay, that just gives me an idea. I just didn't know.
Fortunately for me, the director prior to me was a very organized person, and she's got anything in a red file folder is a permanent record. Anything that's not in a red folder isn't a permanent record. So it would make my job in a case like this a little bit easier.
Okay. Thank you. That's all questions.
Other questions from Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, we've heard testimony from Fairview and Troutdale and what was the other?
Wood Village.
Wood Village. That this activity is not producing, value, and it's not necessary. How would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, obviously I would disagree with that. We think we provide a valuable service not only to the citizens of the county but also to the taxing districts. Yes, it's true that they're all subject to local budget law, and yes, it's true that they're the only county that are subject to a tax supervising conservation commission. But we feel that having access to our technical expertise for their budget staff is worth the effort. In the other 35 counties, if a district has a question, yes, they can call the Department of Revenue and ask that question. Department of Revenue has 4 budget analysts that serve 1,500 taxing districts. In Multnomah County, there are 2 budget analysts to serve 39 taxing districts. So we can provide a lot greater level of detail for those taxing districts. For example, last month, the city of Wood Village, city of Troutdale, hired a new finance manager. Excellent person, great resume, no public finance experience. We met with him for over an hour, going over local budget law, things he has to be aware of, property tax levy calculations, how he goes about making those and where he goes to get the information. That individual would not have been able to call the Department of Revenue and have one-on-one contact with us in a sit-down meeting for an hour. So we think we provide a great service. And a misunderstanding is that we serve mostly the smaller districts. I probably get as many, if not more, calls from the county, city of Portland, the larger districts on technical budget law questions as I do the small counties. So large county, small county, I think they all benefit from our technical expertise. We put on local budget law training, two sessions, one in East County and one in Portland. So budget staff from those districts don't have to travel to Salem to attend Department of Revenue local budget law trainings. So we think we provide service. And quite honestly, I'm not sure about the comment that we require the budget be in a certain format. With all due respect, I would disagree that we require that. We may ask some additional questions and ask for some additional information so that we can plug their budget numbers into our format so that when we produce our annual report, citizens can more easily compare City of Fairview, City of Troutdale, City of Wood Village with each other, or Gresham Barlow School District, Reynolds School District, Centennial School District, being in the same format in our annual report, I think is a great value. We don't require the districts to compile their budgets in any particular way. That's still strictly up to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that you're the right person to ask this question of, but I'm going to take a shot at it. Do you happen to know how things are working in Washington County? Because apparently they have gone over the threshold, but then they got in 2005, according to our information, an exception, and they appear to be providing the information in another way. Do you happen to know how things are working in that county?
Mr. Chair, Senator
Bonamici,
thank you. I'm not real familiar. I think the language of the bill in 2005 was written a little bit funny, so it requires the districts to submit their budget detail to the county so that the county can post it on their website. But the timing of that is such that it's a little bit different than their normal process. A year or so ago, I understood that not all of the counties were submitting the budget information to the county for posting on their website, but I honestly don't know for sure.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a little bit confused. There are 39 taxing districts. Are you telling me that they don't have, that some of them don't have budget committees with public members?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that's correct. By local budget law, a district with a population of over 200,000 that is subject to a tax supervising and conservation commission, such that the commission holds their public hearing. They don't have to have citizen members on their budget committee. So in this case, it's the county, City of Portland, Portland Development Commission, Metro TriMet, Port of Portland, Portland Public Schools, Portland Community College, and Mount Hood Community College don't have citizen members of their budget committee because they have the benefit of having their budget reviewed by the five-member TSCC. Without TSCC, then those 11 districts would have to appoint citizen members to their budget committee.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would think that would be a plus, but that's just me. I mean, I just found it interesting. I looked at the law, and it allows virtually anybody, any county, to create one of these, but there's no provision in the law to get out from it once you've created it, which is interesting. But I would think that having citizen membership on the budget committee closest to the source would be a positive thing. But I'm from Douglas County, so what do I know?
Okay, Tom, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chris Crane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Crane. I'm the city attorney for the city of Fairview. I just want to make a couple of brief comments. We did meet with all five of the Multnomah County commissioners, and they all do support this bill. In fact, in conversation with one of them, throwing around general numbers, it was came up in our discussion that the TSCC costs the county about $300,000 a year, $280,000, it turns out. The county believes it can do it for about $100,000. You know, whether the savings is $150,000, $175,000, or $200,000 is still six figures in these times. That's, you know, maybe it's not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things, but it matters. And obviously, in response to Senator Metzger's comments, yes, the county obviously has a budget process. It's an open public process. They're all elected officials. None of this could be made off the cuff. This decision couldn't be made off the cuff. I want to also affirm Senator Bonamici's comment. Washington County is doing this very well, and in 2005 they came to you with the same faced with the same question, and the legislature didn't deem it, you know, essential that Washington County have a tax supervising conservation commission. All we're asking is that Multnomah County have that same option available to them. And I want to get this on the record, my final point, in case this should ever come up. I have looked at the statutes. I assisted Fairview in drafting the language that was submitted to Legislative Council. I believe what Multnomah County probably has the authority to disband the tax supervising conservation to disband it right now, but it's not entirely clear because, as Senator Cruz points out, disbanding an existing commission is different from not creating one in the first place. So this bill is drafted for the, I think of it as belt and suspenders, but it's drafted for the purpose of clarifying that Multnomah County has available to it the exact same options that were available to Washington County to provide the functions required under the public budget law. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions, Mr. Crane? Okay.
Thank you
for your concise testimony. Moving to our work session. We have appropriate fiscals and revenues.
Cool.
I'm going to move into a work session on Senate Bill 748. Senator Morse,
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 748 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse moves Senate Bill 748 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Morse?
Aye.
Chair Hatch?
Aye. Measure passes. Senator Mona Sanderson will carry the bill. I want to open up a work session on Senate Bill 118. You're the Chancellor and one of the members of the board here. If you both want to come up. And I would also like to announce and amend my comments earlier about holding over at Senate 901. We probably will, unless we get a fiscal statement here in the next hour or two. And we are likely to hold over 637 for some of the same reasons that there's a hiccup in the fiscal reports. And so we will hold over Senate Bill 637. So... to Senate Bill 118, Ms. Richardson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've seen Senate Bill 118 once before. It has to do with the delegation of powers from the State Board of Education, the Chancellor within the Oregon University System. We have a -4 amendment before us that leaves the bill intact, but for removing the power to prescribe enrollment fees from the powers that the board may delegate. We do have fiscal and revenue statements before us as well.
Okay, and we have... the Chancellor and Mr. Van Vliet from the board here. If you want to expand on the amendments and how they relate to this bill, how they would help this.
Well, this bill came about. I'm Tony Van Vliet from Corvallis, Vice Chair of the State Board of Higher Education. This bill came about basically because in the last several years at our retreat, we've been trying to figure out how we could basically spend more time in the board meetings making policy decisions rather than doing some of the smaller mundane things that we often get hit with. Recently our board has determined it would divide itself into three standing committees to deal with some of these things. Some will be then, if their policy decisions would come up to the board, and others can be handled by the chancellor or by the institutional presidents. We think this gives us a little bit more latitude in being a little bit more effective in the way we run our board's meetings and also address some of the more serious issues that are facing us. We're a little bit like arranging, after 4 years, every 4 years, arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic and giving the chancellor the sheet music to hand to the players in the band. And then the board basically has to figure out who's going to be in the lifeboats at the end. So you can see the dilemmas that the board faces.
Wonderful metaphor, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate that analogy. Right.
Unfortunately, it's true.
Chancellor,
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, George Pernsteiner, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. I will not talk about icebergs, but the... this bill, as our Vice President, Mr. Van Vliet, mentioned, came out of a lot of discussion at the board level to determine how best to organize the activities of the board, the chancellor, and the presidents. And they've spent a considerable amount of time thinking about that. And the precepts that they adopted were that the board should provide policy and oversight, and that the board would provide that policy direction to the chancellor, and the chancellor would then provide oversight to the presidents, and then back with performance appraisals of the presidents to the board to show that we've met the expectations the board laid out. The Dash 4 amendments were developed in order that we could ensure that the board was always the ultimate authority on tuition setting. That's what those amendments do, so that there's clarity that that particular function, which has been so central to the discussions which the board has had with the Student Association and with this legislature, would not be delegated by the board, but that other matters could be.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
I can't imagine under what circumstances the board would delegate tuition, but the way that would be bizarre. I mean, the way I see this, it's kind of clarifying the business model that most boards with operate under. So, currently you have to occasionally go through a process to delegate the things that now you can just delegate them and not have to have motions and motions and motions and motions. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that is correct.
Yeah.
In addition, there are certain things that currently the board may, it's questionable whether the board even could delegate. And the other thing that's being done here is that the board now has adopted a committee structure, which it did not have before, and this gives the board the ability to get some of the committees some of those responsibilities so that you can develop expertise at the committee level and not have to redo things twice by bringing it also to the board.
We'll be just like you.
No, that's not.
Well,
that was a bad thing to say.
You know, we on this, I would agree with Senator Cruz. We have gotten our toes wet enough on higher education issues on this committee to know that you can quickly be drowning in minutiae of higher education very quickly. And so I think we understand that dilemma, Senator Metzger.
Well, I hate to throw cold water on this, Mr. Chair, but I'm not supportive of this bill at all. I understand what you're trying to do, what the university is trying to do. I understand that. And I've served on boards, too. But this is a little bit different. We're getting unbridled authority to the board to delegate issues, people who we have confirmed, and are serving, unlike private business and boards, these are state funds, state properties that are held in public trust, and that we have a board that is accountable to us if to be confirmed. When you talk about the different university presidents or the chancellor of the state system, they're not elected, and yet we're giving them potential control of some very significant assets of the state. I mean, controlling, property, acquiring, conveying, selling property. We always would look at this in the best possible scenario that the board would not delegate unfairly or unwisely, and I believe that would be certainly the intent of this legislation to do so. But I think because this is a unique situation where, we are elected to provide a fiduciary responsibility for public properties and the carrying out of duties therein, to turn that to those who are not, I think is a poor delegation of the responsibility entrusted to us. I understand the minutia part, and I certainly could see how that and has been, dominating. And boards generally are vision, they provide direction, they provide a corral in which management operates under, but you're not dealing with public assets there. And CEOs can come and go as a result of those types of actions. I would be much more comfortable, Mr. Chair, if, because these are issues that can bog down a board, in which the board was more specific about the certain issues that bog down their time, that takes them away from vision, and where we could be more specific about those duties that could be conveyed, rather than this very blanket, other than fees, anything in which the public owns or has an interest to can be conveyed. I just think it is a huge hole that I think deserves more attention and more specificity, so that the everyday functions of the university system or individual campuses can be taken away from Mr. Van Vliet and others who need to be working on other issues, but not just say, well, we can't figure it out and we're just going to give you control over everything. I just think that is, I think it's repelling our fiduciary duty to do so.
Senator, let me put your mind a little bit more at rest.
Not that you would, Mr. Van Vliet. I know, because you're honorable. I know that. So
we went through all the things that we have done in the last couple of years on the board and actually tallied up those kind of decisions. We have here page after page of different types of things that we thought needed to be explained as far as what would be under the control of the various committees and what would be delegated. We can get a copy of those to maybe put your mind at rest, but it's a very complete list. And I can also assure you that when you get into things such as the financial control, most of those are full board decisions. We're talking about things that are a notch down from those, because we will be making very serious ones when we talk about tuition, when we talk about properties, when we talk about institutional uses and cooperative programs. All of these are such big policy decisions that those will come before the board. But you have a lot of smaller things, and that's what is on this list, is a lot of those that are detailed out that I think will make you feel much better about the fact that we're not giving away the whole farm as far as offering this particular bill up. The delegation really is a much more reasonable type of delegation, in which I think you'd agree with.
We can
provide that to you,
yeah,
if you'd like to see those.
Well, if I can follow up, Mr. Chair. And I don't doubt that. You've reviewed, you've looked at what's been doing. What I'm doing is the authority going forward that is very broad. You've talked about how the board, and I would certainly hope that'd be the case, that conveying or selling or otherwise real property of the state. I would hope that would be a major decision. And yet, in this language, it does. You, in the future, some board could convey that authority, and I just think that trying to be more specific about this going forward, I think, is absolutely important. I have no doubt that the work that you've done, and as you've analyzed looking back, has been that, but it's always the unintended consequence, and I don't know who the next board is going to be. I don't know what kind of authority someone may give and say, what the heck was the legislature thinking about that? And by the, and I will use, this, I don't know if this is a good example or not, but what goes through my head is my alma mater, which was a private college and had a president who is now gone, who decided to convey property that the college owned into for investment and other places that went totally belly up and hurt the and had the authority to do that without the board, and the board lost a few members as a result of that from alums who were not very happy. So, I'd like to think that wouldn't happen in the university system, but I just think it's a concentration of power going forward that is something I just can't support.
Questions or comments? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us a brief description of the committees Do you have standing
committees? Yes. The new ones that are going to be are governance and policy is one, finance and administration, and academic strategy. Those will be our three standing committees in which members will serve on.
And follow up.
Senator Moore?
Those are committees that do not now exist.
They had existed in part. We had quite a few, but we had a lot of subcommittees working on different projects. This will sort of amalgamate it under more reasonable boundaries of what does what.
Okay. Just a continuing comment. I have wondered how one board can effectively function for seven institutions. And that's always been a question mark in my mind, and the task that you are confronted with to provide meaningful oversight when it's all consolidated. So I see this bill a little bit differently in that I don't see a diminishment of accountability, because it all ultimately flows back to the board, all the actions that are taken. So I think the accountability, you can build that in, and certainly I believe you would. But to have greater flexibility by way of function with these seven institutions, to me, makes sense. So I share the concerns of Senator Metzger with respect to could it get out of hand, but I think you already have accountability measures within your system.
Senator Morris, you can rest assured that we have seven very energetic presidents if things get going one way or the other that let the board know, and the board also has a lot of other checks and balances on it. We have our financial auditing division, which was recently set up, that's done a great job and really given us a handle on where we stand in the budgetary matters in the institution. So I feel the same way as you do, that I think there are enough checks and balances within the board and ultimately with the legislature and the people of the state of Oregon that we can satisfy precepts of this bill.
And I know from discussions with Board Member Van Fleet and with the Chair Paul Kelly that it was the board that brought this legislation forward. Senator Metzger's points are not lost on me, but one of the things this bill does not do is take away the power of the board to hire and fire the chancellor. Senator Cruz?
Hey, Mr. Chair, one other thing this bill does not do is take away the power of the legislature to revisit the issue if it gets out of whack.
Right.
Sure. Okay.
Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the new amendment, the Dash 4 amendment, that deals with the other than the power to prescribe enrollment fees. And just a little curious about why you picked one particular issue to say other than this. I mean, what about, for example, collective bargaining, or is there some other area that
students?
I felt that this one was the one that had disturbed students the most, that were a little bit worried about the fact, and basically it's probably the one that's the most safe. But if that amendment made people feel more secure, then that would be the amendment to put in.
Chair, Senator Bonamici, the current statutes actually have almost a hodgepodge of who is authorized to do what based within them. Collective bargaining currently is delegated to the chancellor, so the board wouldn't have to. And so one of the things that this legislation would do is to permit the board to clarify the roles of itself, its committees, the chancellor, and the presidents. Interestingly, right now, certain things already are delegated and others are not. And there doesn't appear to be, you know, much. Well, I don't know what the reasoning was, let me put it that way, as the legislation evolved over the many years. And so the example you cite already is delegated in the statute.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 118.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 118. Discussion? Seeing none. The amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 118 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 118 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support this bill. I do share some of Senator Metzger's concerns, however, and I'm going to try to not use the water analogy or boat or dive into this, and I think we should give it a try. And as Senator Cruz said, we can come back and revisit it if it's not working. I think there is accountability there in the process anticipated by the bill, and I believe we should give this a try, move it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Morse.
You were next.
You go ahead.
I was just going to suggest it. We could encourage the House to possibly consider a report back to the legislature with respect to the progress of these activities so that we maintain that linkage to the respective education committees.
Senator Metzger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the comments. Again, I won't be able to support the bill. I understand the goal, and I just believe there should be more specificity in the bill because it is a matter of trust going forward, and even good intentions sometimes go awry. And I mentioned the example of my alma mater, who invested personal and or real property of the university, the college, and lost a lot of money. And the board basically didn't know about it. And, yes, the board was held accountable, as was the president, but it was the horse had left the barn at that point. And I think especially with this language, which allows different parts of the university system to specifically be possibly given the authority to invest the property of the state and to sell or convey the property of the state, at the very least, I would think that there should be some limitations on what type of property or what the amounts of property without explicit board approval could be done. Certainly, if you're buying pencils or you're conveying, old wood stoves that are no longer, just going back to a bill of ours that are no longer, that's fine. But I wouldn't want the broad authority because I have seen firsthand something that never thought would happen, and it did happen, and I just wouldn't feel comfortable doing that.
If there is no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Vice Chair
Morse? Aye.
Chair
Howe? Aye. The measure passes. I will carry it on the floor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Morissette is here, so we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 652.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 652 specifies that the school district has the burden of proof under special education services statutes related to a determination concerning the identification, evaluation, IEP, or individualized education program, educational placement, or provision of appropriate education. It specifies that the parent of a child has the burden of proof related to a request for reimbursement for special education and related services. We do not have a fiscal statement on this measure.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. We're here today to advocate for what I think is a very important bill concerning developmentally disabled students and the IEP educational plan for the education. Okay, what is an IEP?
Individualized education
plan. Thank you. One of the problems that has occurred is the burden of proof has shifted to the parents rather than the school districts. Now, school districts are the ESD and the school district are in a much better position to evaluate the needs of the student. The parents have a difficulty in gathering information and defending the needs, and I think it's appropriate that the burden of proof be on the district rather than on the parents. So with that, I'll turn it over to Catherine White, who is an advocate.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities in support of 652. And the council is a federally authorized body who mandates includes policy analysis and systems change activities. And I do have some written testimony here. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Catherine. You don't have to read it. We'll just...
Okay. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act recognized a very long-standing history of discrimination against people with disabilities, access to education, and disempowerment of families and the children. In the history of the Act, from the very, very beginning, there was a lot of emphasis on parental participation in decision-making and also due process and procedural safeguards that were written in the law in response to the long history of discrimination. And in that law, it established that a school district was responsible to provide a free and appropriate education, and that they were to do this through a process of an individualized education program, and that was established by a team of individuals putting together a plan, an individualized plan. Recent media stories have described some of the situations that families still confront and in their effort to get a free and appropriate education. Examples are failure to get access to transition services, failure to get necessary related services, failure to put materials in Braille was one example we heard about recently, and placements that were categorical by disability instead of in the least restrictive environment. We believe that since school districts have the responsibility to provide the free and appropriate education, as Senator Morissette indicated, they do have the final decision in determining what that education plan is. If the families don't agree, then the current situation is that the families must initiate a process to change that. And families are at a significant disadvantage in this process in challenging school districts. The districts have access to sufficiently more resources. They have a paper trail. They have the experts. They have the lawyers. It is a significant, we believe, it's a significant barrier for families to compile the documentations and the experts that they need to challenge the decision of the school district on what was a free appropriate education. And the existing financial and technical hurdles really mean only the most sophisticated families are able to actually take advantage of a vehicle that was put in the original law. Nine other states have made the change and have identified that the burden of proof should be on families rather than in the more traditional way, which is whoever is the moving party. In this case, families are having to challenge something that is in the control of the districts. They are the ones that are forced to ask to provide the justification, and we're saying that burden really needs to be on the school districts. Thank you.
Go ahead, and then we'll ask questions.
Hi, my name is Molly Brown, and I am the proud parent of four children, three of which are autistic. SB 652 is very personally important to me. The most important thing that SB 652 does is protect the child's educational and civil rights to attend their neighborhood school. The effect of SB 652 will be that when a school district removes or takes a student's right to attend their neighborhood school away, they will have to prove that they cannot accommodate the child at the neighborhood school and that the child will show more substantial gains at their alternative placement. I have been to due process with the goal of having my child placed in his neighborhood school and the least restrictive environment. I had the burden of proof at that hearing. I was able to prove that the school district violated my rights and my son's rights under IDEA and denied him a free appropriate education. In the administrative law judge's final order, he wrote, the school district administrator acted more like a ramrod than a facilitator. When discussing the district's placement decision they made under the advice of their attorney, the judge said that he could not follow their logic. It was counterintuitive and contrary to what the plain language of the law states. You would think that my son would have been placed in his neighborhood school by the judge. Well, not so. I was not able to prove that the services available at the neighborhood school were appropriate for my son. There was no way for me to collect the evidence we needed either. Prior to the hearing, we were informed by the district's attorney that we would be arrested for trespassing if we went to the neighborhood school, and the employees were instructed not to speak with us. During the hearing, when we questioned the district about services that we knew were available because of other students we knew personally, the district said they could not discuss the services that are available to other students because of confidentiality. The district did not bring anyone from the neighborhood school to testify about the services available. The district supplied no data about success rates, outcomes, or the effectiveness of either program. The only evidence the district supplied was their employees' opinions. Their opinion was that my son was far too disabled to attend his neighborhood school. They brought no evidence to back up their opinion, no evaluation data, no schoolwork, nothing. They didn't need to. They did not need to prove anything they said. If the district had the burden of proof during my son's hearing, they would have needed to prove their alternative placement was more appropriate than his neighborhood school. They would have needed to bring data and information that supported the idea that my son would make more significant gains in the alternative placement. If the district had the burden of proof in my son's case, they would have not only had the burden of production, requiring them to provide evidence supporting their position, but the burden of persuasion as well. The burden of persuasion requires that if both parties have equally compelling evidence, the party who does not bear the burden should prevail. When considering special education cases, placing the burden of persuasion on districts is logical. When districts and parents are equally persuasive, it just makes sense that the parents should prevail. The parents are the legal guardians and the most knowledgeable about the child. The parents are the only people involved who have a vested interest in the outcomes and future of the child. In my son's due process, the judge could not make a decision on placement because of a lack of information, which was the reason we went to due process. The judge ordered the district to hold another IEP meeting to decide placement for my son. The judge ordered us to return to the place where my son's rights were violated with the people who violated them, who had made it perfectly clear that they would never allow my son to attend his neighborhood school. They had already spent more money than my family makes in 2 years keeping my son out of his neighborhood school and let us know that they would never change their opinion. Needless to say, that was several years ago. We never attended another IEP meeting for my son, and everything we went through in due process was a waste of time. Instead, we homeschooled my son until his special education eligibility IEP had expired and he could enroll as a regular education student. He is currently attending an online charter school with a 504 plan to accommodate his need for extra time he receives and requires no special education, has passed his benchmarks, and has a B average. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. When you were going through this difficulty, was that, what years were that?
It was 06.
06. Well, Ms. White, can you give us a hypothetical of what used to happen, what changed, what happens now, and how this bill would right the ship, as it were?
Mr. Chair, perhaps Bob Jundeff from the Disability Rights Oregon would be better to provide you that legal perspective on where things stand.
Okay. You want to deflect it to him? We can do
that.
Thank
you.
Mr. Jundeff, why don't you come up? Question.
I did hear the
question.
You want
to start with that? I know you have some prepared testimony, or you want? Are you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. We are a protection advocacy organization for people with disabilities in Oregon. Since we were founded in 1977, we have provided legal assistance and advocacy assistance to families and children who are involved in special education matters. This goes back from before there was an IDEA, if you can imagine. And so we've been doing this quite some time. This bill really has to do with the technical evidentiary matter at an administrative hearing. And the best way I could frame it is that there are some general rules about administrative law and who has the burden of proof when one is appealing an agency decision. And generally, the burden of proof goes on the party who is challenging the decision. And the idea is that if you're a person who wants to contest a matter, you need to come up with enough information to show that there's something to contest. It's a basic idea. In the context of IDEA, the calculus is different, and it's really based upon the idea of what's happening in the course of the proceeding. And again, as was stated earlier, you're in a situation in the special education realm in which once there's a question of whether a child should be identified as being eligible for special education, and then there's questions about what services that child should receive. Except in the very rare cases where you have a parent with a great deal of resources to bring to the table, you're normally in a situation which the school district will make those calls. They'll make the evaluation. They have the experts in education, mental health, other types of expertise to evaluate the child and make recommendations as to what should happen. And the parent is normally in a reactive situation and seeking an explanation as to why the school is making decisions and trying to judge as best they can why that is. If there's a dispute in the matter, the parent has a right to appeal that decision. And now we move to the question of, in an appellate realm, who should go forward to show that the burden has been met, that a child is eligible for services and that the services being provided are appropriate. In these situations, in the vast majority of the cases, the school will have all the information or most of the information, unless the parent has the means to go out and hire independent experts, to hire an attorney. And I can tell you just parenthetically that we handle very few cases. Most of the parents that we represent are indigent. And the only cases we are able to handle are cases in which a child is at risk of being excluded from school or has been excluded from school. So these are very rare cases in which a parent can even access our services. So in most cases, the deck is stacked against the parent. And what this bill would do in most cases would be is that if there is a challenge to the school's decision, the school would have to bring forth its information to show that they've met the threshold of proof to show that the child is receiving a free and appropriate public education, which is the standard. What's the difference? The difference is that if a school district has not done its homework, if it has made an arbitrary decision, we've seen cases in which with non-English speaking parents, in which parents are asked to merely sign a form without a proper explanation as to what the decision has been for them. In those cases, it's left to the parent to come up with enough information, understanding, and resources to put on a case to show that the school has been wrong. And that really, in most cases, is going to be an insurmountable barrier. And so that's why, in our estimation, it's only fair for the school to make the case, go forward and show from the information they have that they've made a decision, maybe not the best decision, but a decision that comports with the law.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a question, and I'm not sure if, excuse me, if Mary Ann Linden is here and is testifying.
She's not here today. Okay, because I received the the written testimony, and she submitted part of the Supreme Court decision, which I really appreciate because I was trying to read it on my phone, and it was real. And my phone's not supposed to be on in this room, and the letters were tiny. But she only submitted the dissenting opinion, and I have a question, Bob, about I'm just trying to figure out why we're at the state level dealing with this issue. I understand the goal and support the goal. I'm just trying to figure out what happened in the Supreme Court. And they said because there wasn't a standard in law, does that give the states the right to set their own standards? Is that sort of legally where we are? Because there's a Supreme Court opinion that says that the burden's the other way than what we're trying to accomplish.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, that case came before the Supreme Court because there is nothing in the federal law that sets a burden of proof in this area, and so it is left to state law to set the standard.
Okay, thank you. That must be in the main part of the opinion, so we only have the dissenting opinion.
We only said the dissenting.
Right.
Okay, thank you. And I have Peter Berger from
the dissenting opinion.
Lincoln. Did you still want to testify?
Right. There's nothing here.
My testimony will be very brief.
Thank you.
My name's Peter Berger, and my wife and I compiled the original draft of SB 652. SB 652 was written to begin to level the scales of justice for disabled children and their legal guardians. SB 652 is based on fairness and common sense. As you've heard, there are many reasons why the burden should be shifted to districts. But I believe the most important reason is that SB 652 supports basic rights. Brown versus Board of Education stopped segregation and supported the right for all children to be able to attend their neighborhood schools. We believe that if a district is going to take a child's right to attend their neighborhood school away, that the district should have the burden to prove why they are doing so. To clarify this, I ask everyone to just take a moment to consider this comparison of basic due process rights and burden of proof. When the state attempts to put an accused criminal in a more restrictive environment, that individual's rights are protected. The accused is provided an attorney if they cannot afford one. It is the state agency that has the burden of proof when attempting to remove an individual from the rest of the community. It just makes common sense that we provide disabled children who have not committed any crime to at least the same rights and protections before removing them to a more restrictive environment. And for that reason alone, I believe SB 652 should be passed.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Peter? Thank you. And I think Sonia Fisher, did you want to testify on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sonia Fisher. I'm an attorney in private practice in Lake Oswego, and I'm the chair of the Policy Committee for Families and Communities Together, which is a statewide cross-disability family advocacy coalition of all the organizations in the state. We support Senate Bill 652 and urge you to do so as well. I'm not going to repeat the information that you received throughout the testimony today, but just one key point that I wanted to emphasize. The Supreme Court decision that we were talking about, Schaefer v. Wiest, was a case in Maryland, and it dealt specifically with the issue of burden of proof. The issue, the state of Maryland did not designate who had the burden of proof, so in that case, it was the moving party that had the burden. The Supreme Court decision in the main decision said that issue was not before it to deal with the burden issue in regards to the state of Maryland. Since they didn't make the decision, they were keeping the law as it is in that state. It did leave it open for states to make a change to the burden of proof, and there are many states across the country that have done that. So that's really what this bill is about today, is to ask you to say that in the state of Oregon, that school districts should have the burden of proof, and the key issues are that the school districts have the information, they basically hold all the cards, they make the decisions, and they need to be held accountable for what those decisions are. Parents are not in a position to have the resources, to have the attorneys, to have the experts, to have the evaluations to meet that burden. And so for those reasons, the FACT Coalition urges your support of Senate Bill 652.
Thank you. Ms. Fisher, you're an attorney working with that group?
I'm an attorney in private practice. About 80% of my practice is family law and about 20% is special education.
And, you know, we keep hearing these difficult situations involving judges and court orders and this. Do you believe this, if it's enacted into law, would create more of that or reduce that?
No, I think what this bill does is it sends a message of accountability to school districts, which would actually reduce litigation or due process hearings. The simple fact is that school districts will have to be held accountable for their placement decisions, for the IEPs, for the goals that they put in place, and that will just raise the bar to a certain degree so that there won't be as much conflict.
Questions for Ms. Fisher?
I have one.
Ambassador.
I'd like to rely on your expertise. Do you have the bill in front of you?
Do I have the bill, the actual bill?
Yeah.
You know, I do not have the bill, but I know quite a bit about the bill. So.
Well, I'm just curious, just from my understanding, on page 2, where it talks about the parent of the child has the burden of proof in a request for tuition reimbursement, and it has mm-hmm. two qualifiers. I'm just trying to understand what that means, what that does. That would be lines 10 through 16 on page 2, the reverse.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I can tell you, because I've talked with Disability Rights, or I've heard their position, Disability Rights Oregon, and studied this component of the bill and looked at the issue statewide, that in some states, the school district has the burden in all special education proceedings. This bill puts the burden on parents for issues related to tuition reimbursement. This bill is much more conservative than what other states have decided to do, because basically in just the scenario where a parent says, I don't like what the public school is offering me, I want my child to go to this private school, the parent will have the burden in those specific situations.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does answer my, Mr. Chair, it's just, and I don't know the relevance of it. I have to process that, but just dealing with the other issue we're dealing with, virtual charter schools that are that are sponsored by districts, but some of which the services are provided by a private entity. And I'm just trying to think, is there something here that might change something for a parent based on the other issue we're dealing with? I don't know, but I just... I don't know if you have any insight into that, but we have a number of virtual schools, online schools, that provide that districts contract with private entities, private services. So I just wonder if a special education parent took their kid to a virtual online school with the services who are provided by a private entity, whether this would change in any way the burden that they would have or that the district would have in that case.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I believe if a child that receives special education is placed through the school district in such a setting as you're describing, then the school district would continue to have the burden. It's also my understanding for those specific situations where a parent unilaterally moves a child out of the public school system into a private placement, that they would have the burden if they wanted to seek tuition reimbursement.
Okay. You said other states go beyond this. In what way could you...
Yes. Chair House member of the committee, some other states, and I don't have the number, Catherine White actually might have the number, the burden of proof is for all issues related to special education proceedings. There is not an exception for tuition reimbursement.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, well, that ends our testimony. No one else has signed up. We do not have the appropriate paperwork here from Fiscal and Revenue, so we will have to carry this bill over. And I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 652. I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 537. We have some amendments. Data?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 537 relates to auditing of district business practices, school district business practices. The Dash 1 amendments before us replace the general measure, and they permit this the District Best Business Practices Advisory Committee to audit and evaluate business practices of districts, and it permits this committee to contract with the Secretary of State to conduct audits and to contract with private entities for evaluations. We do not have a fiscal measure, a fiscal statement on this measure.
Okay. And we have some people here, Cindy Robert and Chuck Bennett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Chalkboard Project. I'm proud to be before you today with a bill that's actually pretty simple, and we've talked to most people about it already, and although some people are a little wary because they're not sure what we're up to, I assure you that I'm about to tell you what we're up to, and it's very simple. And an intense focus nationally to improving student achievement has forced many school districts to start looking at better ways to make sure more money gets into the classroom by cutting down on business costs. An effort to uncover such efficiencies in Oregon brought forward two review processes. Both help specific volunteer school districts or ESDs to find efficiencies and then help others by posting results of those audits and reviews and sharing best practices with all other school districts. So in spring of 2007, the Chalkboard Project contracted with Oregon Association of School Business Officials, OASBO, Angie Peterman's here to answer questions on that, to conduct reviews of school business operations in five districts. At the same time, the legislature created a District Best Business Practices Advisory Committee and authorized the Department of Education to contract with the Secretary of State to do audits of school districts. So the scope of the two processes were the same. Each is limited to the business practices, including operations such as building construction, food services, financial management, and transportation. But the depth of the two processes were very different. The Secretary of State conducted a comprehensive, intense, on-hand audit of an ESD, Multnomah Education Service District, and by contrast, OASBO conducted much broader reviews, not as in-depth, but broader, more services, and more best practices, lessons from each one of five school districts. The other difference is that the cost. The state audit of ESD cost almost $250,000, whereas the Chalkboard granted $87,000 to OASBO to do five reviews. So the reviews and audits have both been very valuable. They both serve a very big purpose, and I provided to you a study that was done by Eco Northwest that described both processes, how they were done, what the results were, what kind of information was given to the districts and to the ESDs that were helpful, and how those were posted and made available to others to follow as far as best practices go. I sent them to you over email, because you're all looking at me strangely. I sent them about a week ago, and I'm hoping you got them. If not, I'd be happy to provide them to you in a printed form, although I'm always worried I offend people by doing that. What this bill does is it simply takes the recommendations in that Echo Northwest report and makes them reality. The recommendations were, number one, the legislature look at the different kinds of audits and reviews and determine do they all need to be as in-depth as the Secretary of State audit, or do some of them need to be more broad but not as financially focused and in-depth. And the report also suggested that there might be a way to combine the two processes to make sure that the full extent of the available resources were given to every school business district. Now, the problem is the way the Best Business Practices Advisory Committee was passed in 2007, it only allows the Department of Education to use the Best Business Practices Advisory Committee to work with the Secretary of State. So what we're asking is simply that you give the Department of Education the ability to also contact with others, not for audits, because that is, in fact, a Secretary of State authority, not anyone else's, but for what we're calling evaluation, so that the review type process that OASBA did could still occur, maybe in conjunction with the Secretary of State. When I talked to Secretary Brown and Barry Peck in her office about this, there was possibility of maybe combining the two efforts later on. Not every audit needs to be in depth. Some of them need to be broader. Some of them also are really big. Some of the SDs are large enough that we may need to do both, where we have a best business practices evaluation going in first, and then the Secretary of State follows. So we're looking at ways to better allow them to partner, especially during these economic times when, frankly, the Secretary of State is not going to have money to do these, and we'd like to open up the process for the BPPAC to continue and work with others, like Chalkboard, granting to OASBA that can continue offering business reviews to schools.
Thank you, Chuck. Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Just to highlight a couple of things Cindy mentioned that are very important to us. We work with Chalkboard, with Cindy, on putting these amendments together. Having served on the Best Business Practices Advisory Committee, we are in the midst of developing best business practices. Clearly, the fiscal situation in the state was creating a huge question mark on whether there would be an ability to fund the Secretary of State's continuing performance auditing program, which is in fact feeding the best business practices its information for developing the kind of information it's expected to share out with school districts that result from these performance audits. And having had the experience of the five evaluations that were done by the school business officials under a grant from Chalkboard, we realize that there is a real opportunity for a kind of public-private activity to at least keep this activity alive, assist us in developing the kind of guidelines that would feed into performance audits when the Secretary of State is again funded for this kind of activity, and keep this committee working. There is plenty to do, but it does need information, and this evaluation process that Chalkboard and OASBO have been involved in is just providing a wealth of information, and this committee is in place to really process it and begin developing additional information for school districts, for the legislature, as well as for future Secretary of State performance audits. It keeps a program alive we could lose in a bad economic time. So I hope you'll support our amendments and move this bill along. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Haas, members of the committee, I'm Angie Peterman. I currently serve as executive director for the Oregon Association of School Business Officials. And as has been mentioned by both Cindy and Chuck, we were very excited to have the opportunity to put together a grant program that allowed us to go out and do five business and operations reviews, is how we referred to them. The five districts that we completed included Beaverton, Albany, Eugene 4J, Yoncalla School District, and Burns. And in every instance, we walked away with examples of best practices that we could share with others. And we also were able to provide, I think, some very positive feedback to those districts in areas that they might look at strengthening their practices and processes. We were able to draw upon the experience of my peer group from across the country, as well as some of our business partners and agency partners that also were involved in this process. And so for actually about $70,000 and a lot of volunteer time and effort, we were able to go in and do these five reviews. In Beaverton, for example, we highlighted their risk management program and their self-insured program and the fact that they have generated in excess of $1 million in savings from their risk management process and the self-insurance program they have in place for their property and liability insurance, which is substantial. And they had great tools and tips and techniques that we could, in fact, publish and make available to other districts so that they can pick those same practices up and use them. When we went to Yonkala School District, you know, Yonkala's 338 students when we went in there last year to do their review, but we didn't have any problem identifying some best practices. We also were able to give them, I think, some real insight. When we were in Burns, they were in the midst of an upheaval over budget crisis, and the team that was there was actually there and able to provide some resources immediately that were of benefit to that community to see them through a very difficult time, and at the same time be able to provide additional feedback and input and information that those districts are able to use. Through the Chalkboard Project, we've actually been able to take those five districts, highlighting their best practices, and we're working in conjunction with the state of Pennsylvania and a group of other states to put together an electronic resource center where we're actually publishing those best practices, making available those tools and techniques to districts. We have one more district that we're working with at this point. That is Salem-Keizer, and we'll be completing an on-site at Salem-Keizer probably in May. The unfortunate reality is with the economic times and the current situation, obviously, resources are declining to the point districts are finding it difficult to imagine, as much as they'd like to have these reviews done, how they're going to afford to have them done. And so we're looking at creative ways of partnering and trying to continue that as best we can. I'm sure happy to answer questions. I don't want to take an inordinate amount of your time to talk about the process, but I think there's some very positive things, and it serves, as Cindy mentioned, I think, a different purpose than the Secretary of State Division of Audit's function. And unless, I mean, if you're looking at a Yonkala school district and going in from the Secretary of State's office to do a performance audit, I find it hard to imagine how that's going to work effectively for the district or for the Secretary of State, because it's such a small group, small entity. And yet, if you look at Multnomah ESD and the procurement audit that was done there, I think it was very beneficial as you looked at the size and scope of what it was that they were trying to do while they were there.
Okay, thank you. Tricia?
Thank you, Chair Hass and members. Tricia Yates with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm here also in support of this bill, specifically the Dash 1 amendments. Our members have found these business best practice reviews to be very helpful. We see it as a complementary and cost-effective partner to the Secretary of State audits you've heard discussed previously. When Angie mentioned the best practices that have been found, our members are particularly excited by findings such as in Yonkala, where there's an outstanding food service program. They serve more than 50%, or they have greater than 51% participation in their program at a secondary level. Or if you take Albany, they have a wonderful facilities maintenance program that could be a model for other districts. These are the kinds of things that our members are looking for. It's cost effective and it provides additional options for districts, and so we urge your support of these amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Just to be clear, can Chuck, you walk us through, or Cindy, the how the funding would work?
Sorry, how the what?
The money part would work.
Yes, Senator Haas, members of the committee, again, Cindy Robert with Chalkboard Project. In the past, the Secretary of State was given the money to do the best business practice review audits through the Oregon Department of Education. They were given $500,000 for the last biennium. Whether there will be money for them to do that in the next biennium to fund ODE and BPAC, I'm not sure. As far as the audit, the reviews that Chalkboard and OASPO did, we granted them the money. Will there be money in the future from Chalkboard? Hopefully. We hope to continue these practices. But one of the reasons that we need to be involved in the Best Business Practices Advisory Committee is simple. Chalkboard was not supposed to be around forever. We actually thought we'd come in and make significant change in the education world in 3 years. Well, here it is 5 years later, and we still haven't made significant change. But we're trying. We still have our principles. It's hard to change. It's hard to change. You all know it's hard to make change. But we're doing the best that we can. And in this particular instance, I think we were able to show a commitment to doing something by contracting with someone else who already had a great reputation in the education stakeholder community. They went and did it. We were pretty hands-off. We were pretty hands-off, gave them the money and said, help schools figure out how to do this. Would we continue to do that? We sure hope to. Our finances and our foundation finances are no different than state finances. They're down, but we certainly hope to be able to continue to do these programs. And this legislation simply opens it up so that we can have that kind of partnering go on.
Mr. Chairman, the way the money works essentially is through the Department of Education contracting. It now expands the contracting authority for the department to extend contracts to include these evaluations, and they can do it with other, in the case of evaluations, with other organizations other than the Secretary of State, who they are authorized to contract for audits. Problem is, there's no money for audits at this point. Mm-hmm. So it essentially creates a formal, it formalizes what has been a very successful relationship between Chalkboard and OASBO, and brings it in a little closer to the Department of Education and to this best business practices organization. It's just sort of, you know, kind of formalizing the situation, I think.
Mr. Chair, if I might just add, both Angie Peterman was both involved with our process and on the best business practices process for ODE and the Secretary of State. On top of that, John Tapania, who wrote the report I provided to tell you, was in both processes. So we've had a good sampling of people doing both and saying, you know what, this could work, this could fit. Talked to the Secretary of State about it and to Barry Pack, and it was kind of, yeah, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe this is a good fit, because we do have to change the parameters based on the economy right now. So it's not something where it's black, white, and we're just talking about joining them. There's been a gray area the whole time, and now we're just talking about formalizing that.
And I totally agree with that. I would not, though, want us to rely on these kinds of evaluations for districts that agreed to have them done as a substitute for doing performance audits for whoever. You know, I'm thinking Reynolds 3 or 4 years ago maybe would have been a good candidate.
Mr. Chair, that's why we were very clear about changing the language. When the 537 first came out, it was not quite as clear. We're not saying that other entities should be able to do audits. We're simply saying they should be able to do evaluations. Evaluation was even toned down from a review, because audit and review are sometimes used interchangeably, especially by your accountants, perhaps, annual audits, annual reviews. So we even took it a step further to make sure there's clarification that these groups are not doing audits by using the word evaluation.
We're very concerned, I think, like you, Mr. Chair. This performance audits of school districts have been few and far between, as you know, and we have just completed the first one in, geez, a decade and a half at Multnomah ESD. It was very positive. We want to keep this process going and would hate to see anything interrupted, including a budget shortfall. So this is our way of sort of keeping this process alive in some formal sense. We have got to get to performance audits of school districts, and we will. We can't afford it right now, but we can keep the kind of information development to create the baselines for these kinds of audits going with Chalkboard's help, and they've been a tremendous contributor to Oregon education through this program. We really appreciate it.
Any questions?
Just an observation to Chairs. At least one reason why Reynolds wasn't audited is that they didn't request to be audited,
right?
Because this is a voluntary program, and I think it's kind of self-explanatory.
Yeah, that's my point.
Do know, though, that we are helping those districts like Reynolds, Multnomah ESD, others that would like to be audited. We do work with them to encourage them toward this. This has been very successful. Folks that are dealing with this, particularly thinking of Multnomah ESD, are coming. Superintendent Hitchcock came in with a very positive reaction. This has not been something that's been an easy sell to school districts, but it's going quite well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, while it is voluntary, which is great, and people don't want to do it sometimes, those are the same people who are going to the website and looking at all the ideas that were posted and following up on those. As voyeurism, as education stakeholders come out and try to figure out how to best get that information out. And we're happy to use it that way, and we're happy at Chalkboard to continue to pay to post those findings so that people can share.
I guess if a person just walked in from the outside and looked at the language of this bill, they'd say, what in the world are you doing? When you have performance audits that are evaluations and are engaging another entity to do evaluations, I'm wondering if we should be focusing on the scope of work that is done by the Secretary of State's office, so we're not doubling up. Could you elaborate a little bit more? I know you were talking about it, but it just seems a little strange to do a performance audit, which is really an evaluation, and then evaluate again.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Senator Morse. A performance audit is really a far more, this is just a layman speaking, and I think you would see the same thing in watching the Secretary of State. It's a far more formalized process and involves a set of agreed upon principles in the auditing profession that are quite specific. What's going on in the evaluations, while rigorous, is a different thing than this kind of specific performance auditing. And I think for our purposes on the Best Business Practices Committee right now, this really is the way for us to go in terms of developing information, developing best practices. The audits are very expensive. They're very, very detailed. That's what kind of caught my attention, is how detailed they are, and that we'll be working toward those, but this is just not the time we're going to be able to get them done financially. Am I getting at what you're asking, or am I still wandering around?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, the point being that if we're going to engage the Secretary of State in these audits, they ought to be meeting the needs of the institutions. And if the performance audit is done in a way that's not necessarily meeting your needs, how do we reconstruct that in a way that meets the standards of that office? And so,
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I think you ask a really good question. How do we narrow the scope? And in the report I sent you, it does, in fact, talk about how can you narrow the scope of what technically the Secretary of State does for a performance review or an audit. The fact is that their process is a regulatory review. Her process is a peer review. And just in the essence of those two differences, from $250,000 to do one ESD, to 70 to do five reviews is a huge difference. They both give great change ideas to the districts. That being said, one has more of a come back and fix it, or we'll help you fix it, you must fix it attitude. The other ones are ideas. Ours are ideas. I think Angie's dying over here to answer that question, though.
Sorry, no. But Chair Hass, Senator Morris, the processes are very, very distinct and very, very different. The Secretary of State Division of Audit's process is, in fact, a compliance audit in many respects, and deals very much with looking at the statutory requirements and what's involved with those statutory requirements, and then investigating in depth within the district the district's compliance in all aspects of those laws and statutes. At the same time, the Best Practices Business Advisory Committee has attempted to provide some additional input as to how Secretary of State might identify some best practices in that process, as well as being able to affirm that the district is in compliance with all the legal requirements necessary under procurement, for example, with Multnomah ESD. In our review process, we start with a self-evaluation, and we're looking at eight different areas of operation within the district, not a single area. So we've looked at communications and administration. We look at food service, transportation, facilities and maintenance, the entire financial area, risk management. And in that process, we start with a self-evaluation where we ask some standard questions that are based upon what on a national level have been identified as best practices. Are you doing these things? Do you do these things? And then use those to develop then I think the process that we use more in depth as we go in and spend time within the district. It's very intensive with interviews, looking at policies, contracts, procedures, but it's not so stringent with the compliance aspect. We're not looking to see from a procurement perspective, did the district comply with every law relative to procurement, because we're looking more systemic at those issues. Does that help?
Well, I think, thank you, Mr. Chair. School districts are required by law to have external audits. Mm-hmm. Do those audits look at the same issues that the Secretary of State does in their audit in terms of compliance?
Chair Haas, Senator Morris, no, I do not believe that they do. We've looked at, through the advisory committee, making sure that we're looking in areas that are not already being audited. Financial audits are not something that Secretary of State is going in and doing because they are already being performed by outside third parties. Our process does not go in and try to recreate a financial audit either. We do spend a lot of time looking at the results of 3 years of audits and management letters and so forth to familiarize ourselves more with the processes and what's in place in the district. But I don't believe that either process is duplicating those financial audits.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, Cindy Roberts, Chalkboard. The financial audit comes in and looks at the numbers. How did these numbers work? How did you make them work? An operational business review comes in and teaches you how to make them work better, how to spend better, what process you can do. We had somebody come in when we first started talking about this chalkboard project, and we said, we want you to go to these school districts and find out how they buy a ream of paper. This is a national guy who'd been doing these kind of studies for years. He brought us back our check and said, I can't do it. Everybody in this state procures differently. Some are buying boxes through their ESD. Some are having the secretary go down and buy it with petty cash. I cannot compare procurement in this state. So what we're talking about is not how much money you spend on paper. We're talking about how you consolidate with other people and help to make it affordable. So the finances are a little different. One's just the numbers. One's the activity.
I get, Mr. Chair, I'll let this go, but I would just make one comment that the way I read this bill, the department is not obligated to first do the performance audit with the Secretary of State before engaging in an evaluation. And in a budget-limited environment, to do both may not be the best use of resources. The latter, to actually do the benchmarking with best practices, is probably going to yield far greater results than a blue bowl on a performance audit from the Secretary of State. That's my point.
We would sure agree, Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris. We would really agree, and that's exactly why this bill's here, is to keep that avenue open. We have become increasingly convinced there won't be funding for performance audits. What will be available is the kind of private funding that will allow this sort of evaluation to occur, and we want to keep this going. And it may be that in a future session you'll take a look at this and say, you know, this really is what we had in mind, rather than performance audits. Performance audits may be just too narrow an activity for the legislature in terms of developing best practices. It just may not be the right vehicle to get there.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make one final comment. One of the issues here is, again, there's not going to be a lot of money for the Secretary of State process. Will there be money for the review process through Chalkboard? Hopefully us and other private entities. But the fact is, in order for this process to work effectively, we have to have all the stakeholders involved. And that's why the Best Business Practice Advisory Committee comes into use. Chalkboard comes to them, and we have some legitimacy in what we're doing, but we also have the stakeholders backing up what we're doing, and it seems like a good time to meld those two so that we can all sit at the one table and do something together.
Mayor Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarification that I just noticed in light of Senator Morse's question to clarify, because throughout the and I'm looking at the Dash 1 amendments, sometimes it says uses and sometimes it uses or, and so I just want to clarify that both will not be required in every instance. Sometimes it'll be an audit and sometimes it'll be an evaluation, which isn't necessarily clear.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, you're right, and the reason sometimes it's and sometimes it's or is because both of them can do evaluations, but only one of them can do an audit.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We will have to carry this over. We don't have the correct paperwork.
If we suspend rules,
so I'll close hearing on Senate Bill 537, and I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 443. This is the Steering Commission. And we're not going to take testimony on this. Rather, we're going to update the amendment, and Dana and perhaps Senator Cruz could update us on that. And then, if it's your choosing, we will refer it to the Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you'd like to do that, we'll have to do a unanimous consent to suspend the rules because we do not have a fiscal statement. However, I can tell you that the Dash 1 amendments add to the bill that a senator and representative will be commissioned as ex officio members of the Education Enterprise Steering Commission, and it permits the Department of Education to accept contributions on behalf of the commission, and it appropriates $130,000 to the Department of Education for the Education Enterprise Steering Commission.
Senator Cruz, do you have anything to add to that?
You were I was involved. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We thought it appropriate that the Legislative Assembly stay engaged in the process that we've been engaged in. This formalizes it. In consultation with James Sager from the Governor's Office, I asked him, I said, what is the minimal amount of general fund we could put in this bill and still demonstrate that the state has skin in the game, and which is why how he came up with $130,000, I'm not sure, but I will trust that that was a figure. Morgan's laughing, so maybe he has something to do with that. I don't know. We're clearly expecting contributions from private sources to help this enterprise move forward. We've got commitments to that objective. Our thought was that 130 demonstrates a commitment by the state and might pass the gag test in Ways and Means. So that was how we arrived at that figure.
Senator Cruz, you don't need to dress it up quite like that. Senator Metzger?
Well, I have concerns about the bill simply because I just kind of wonder what it really does. We've already got this commission. You know, we're kind of memorializing in statute what we already have. We've got a number of organizations, including this one, that supposedly are there to coordinate professional development and information. And I guess it seems like redundancy. I just I'm not convinced that we're actually making any progress on this. By doing this, and I don't know where the Education Enterprise Steering Commission that currently exists, how that would be any different other than the appropriation, additional appropriation. So, I just kind of wonder what the impact is, and I just I'm not convinced there is one.
Mr. Chair,
Bruce,
the commission that currently exists is nothing formal, and it was short term and designed to explore what we needed to do for professional development. And I served on that, and what we came up with was the fact that what we really need is something that would allow school districts the ability to go to a place, a point in time, a place, in this case a website, to be able to find out what sort of resources they would have available in their own school district for teachers to do further education or whatever level of professional development they wanted. And And so I understand that we did have that commission. This is a continuation and putting in place the ability of that to move forward in time to continue to look at resources that are available, determine whether they meet standards, and make sure that they are out into the future offered to schools, to teachers, for professional development. The purpose of this is to make sure this is ongoing and continuous out in time, and hopefully over the course of time, the offerings available for teachers for professional development will become incredibly rich and allow any teacher to have access to those sorts of resources they need to better serve their students. So this does memorialize it, it formalizes it, and I think it's an appropriate next step to what we have been engaged in the last couple of years.
Other comments, Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share some of Senator Metzger's concerns. I also have some concerns, and I was trying to look at what the Dash 1 amendment did and what it replaces, but it looks to me like this coordinate information and education technology, coordinate professional development for school improvement language remains in the bill, which seems to me to be pretty broad. The intent of the bill, I think, is important. I think staff development is critical, and it was interesting to look through the staff development statewide teacher professional development survey that was provided. But in response to your comment, Senator Cruz, about research to determine what's available in one's own district regarding professional development, I think the districts are already doing that. I would hope that they would be doing that in terms of letting their own teachers know what was available. So I'm a little concerned about how broad this is. I also just want clarification on the, and I apologize for this, but I spent a lot of time on an Oregon Law Commission Enabling Statutes Work Group, and so ex officio, the language is not apparently in the amendment, but it's my understanding because of this language that the term is 3 years, but if a member is no longer a member, they will not continue to serve. Is that the way you understand it, Dana?
I'm sorry, Senator. I'm not following.
Well, you said that the legislative members are ex officio, meaning that they're there because of the nature of their office as a legislator.
Mm-hmm.
And on page 2 of the dash ones, it says that the term is 3 years. So there may be somebody who's appointed who's no longer a legislator. So it's my understanding, just to clarify for the record, that it says a member serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority, that the intent is to make sure that it is a legislator who's actually still serving in the legislature. Is that
Ms. Chair, Senator Bonamici, if I could, that may be something that may need a little fixing. It would be my intent that every 2 years when the legislature meets, that this would be appointments that the president and the speaker would make for the biennium. So that could be, we maybe need some clarifying language. Well, for the other members of the,
right.
but for that could be some clarifying language. And Mr. Chair, if I could quite
Cruz.
Speak to Senator Bonamici's other concerns about the language being broad. It's broad intentionally. And you are right that a lot of districts have developed some very good professional development tools, but there is not necessarily any really good way for them to share that information with other districts. And this would allow an exchange so that the good tools that District A has could also be accessed by District B, and also to be able to import other professional development tools that are developed even in other states. And you know, it's just to have a centralized place for all of this good work to reside so that it's available to all districts. And I think that was the intent of it.
Thank you, Senator.
Further comments, Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could somebody offer some enlightenment on the task of coordinating information and educational technology in light of the discussions that we've had with respect to virtual education, mm-hmm. charter schools, all of the above?
What specifically?
Well, Section 3 uh-huh. says the commission shall, and enumerated in that list is coordinate professional development, which you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is coordinate information and educational technology. What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I know exactly where you're going, and I don't think when we drafted this we were envisioning virtual curricula for the K-12 system specifically, but I would suggest that this does fit in that perspective as part of professional development, educating educators on what sort of offerings would be available for them to import into their curricula. So this does get to a whole other agenda that is before this committee. But yeah, there is a linkage there. Is that what the point you're driving at?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. It is. I have a feeling though that the bill is a half a loaf.
Well, but you got the other half in your bill.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Senator Bonamici.
Another question, and I guess I'll ask Senator Cruz, mm-hmm. since he seems to be answering the questions here. Section 3 that we were just talking about with mm-hmm. Senator Morris, can you talk about coordinate professional development for school improvement? Because that says that the commission shall coordinate professional development for school improvement. So does that mean that it's not going to be up to the districts to coordinate professional development? And I know OSBA offers a lot of professional development. Is this transferring that responsibility of coordinating professional development to the commission?
No. Coordinate, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, coordinate professional development for school improvement, that's what this is about. This isn't mandating anything. This is just building a resource base. So I don't read that as a mandate on anything.
And we do have testimony from the Dean of the School of Education at George Fox, who says Oregon currently has no centralized dissemination information system about professional development, nor is there a centralized way to share resources and experiences among stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And I think the testimony we had and we heard in this day on this was to get at that, was to get at that very issue.
And I see, Mr. Chair, I see that addressed in paragraph 2, mm-hmm. The commission shall, the website shall display calendar, post feedback, and that seems very different from the commission shall coordinate professional development. Mm-hmm. So I just want clarification that what the intent is for because the way that it reads, it does read as a mandate. The commission shall coordinate professional development, and I just want to make sure that that's not intended to take any responsibilities okay. away from districts themselves.
Mr. Chair, could I call in
the troops?
Some Cruz, smart guys.
Senator Cruz, this is highly unusual for you to call in someone, but of course.
With the chair's permission.
Yes.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, to answer the question that Senator Cruz has asked, the two provisions in the bill that relate to information technology and school improvement, I think are a reference to, for the record, Lindsay Capps, Oregon Education Association. The two provisions you see in the bill that relate to information technology and school improvement are intended to broadly guide this commission in terms of providing information across districts via the website on the various professional development resources that are available for the purpose of school improvement. So if a school has a specific need that they want to achieve, whether it's improving achievement among Title I students, if it's addressing specific goals, that they have access to an online resource where they can select resources that are available to them. The coordination piece, as I see it as well, is to create a calendar for districts to see if an ESD is providing a professional development seminar, that they know that that's on the calendar, that they could actually send teachers, educators to that function, that essentially that there is a some sort of information base that's provided across the state. We currently don't have that. So that's how I see the coordinate function. In terms of the information technology, that's very simple. It's helping educators integrate technology into their classroom, into their instruction. So there's a lot of work that's been done along these lines. I know that there's been some partnerships with Intel and other technology companies to help bring those resources into classrooms. And so the intent of that would be for the commission to look at how that could be brought into the classroom environment. That's my understanding of the intent of those two provisions. Do you want to add anything?
Okay. Chair Haas, members of the committee, Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Chalkboard Project. And I would just point out two quick things. First off, to the question about whether districts are already providing this information, the answer is right now they do, but it's all over the map. This brings it all together under one house. Secondly, just to kind of support what Lindsay just referenced, you all should have had a document, facts on Senate Bill 443, that is distributed to you all and helps explain that technology support.
Mr. Chair, also for the record, I just want to point out that this isn't the first time that the OEA has come to my aid. So,
Mr. Chair, just
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lindsay and Phil, for the clarification. That's not the way it's drafted, though, because Section 3 has separate responsibilities for coordinating professional development and coordinating information and education technology. The website, it's not part of the website. It's a separate it's two separate provisions, actually three in Section 1. And then 2 is the section that deals just with the website. So it's just the way that I'm reading it, it's just not clear that this is all related to the website. It says the commission shall coordinate professional development, coordinate information educational technology. So I really appreciate the clarification because it's not what it says in the bill.
Mr. If I could, if you would go down into 2 on sub C where it says provide contact information for professional development programs, so that does link back in.
Understand. Okay. Doesn't solve my problem.
Okay. Well, any other discussion before we entertain a motion to refer this to Ways and Means? Senator Morris, we'll have to change the rules first. Go ahead.
Okay, well, it would seem to me that the amount of money that we do spend on continuing education right now, you could do it with redirected funds and not have a fiscal on this, but that's...
Well, and that may be the decision made in Ways and Means.
Yeah, okay. Okay, we can do that.
First, suspend...
We can just adopt the amendment.
We can adopt the amendment before we suspend the rule.
Okay.
Do you want to do
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chair, we're in work session. Yes.
Work session.
I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 443.
Senator Morris moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 443. And discussion? Seeing none, so amended. We will need unanimous consent to change and suspend our rules in order to pass this measure directly to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move unanimous consent to suspend the rules to move Senate Bill 443 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is that close?
That's pretty close. any discussion on that motion?
Yes.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is on the unanimous consent.
Oh, no. Sorry.
Seeing none objection. No objection. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 443 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Second.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 443 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, then it be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Is there any discussion, Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate the point that I think this is, in general, a good idea. I'm not sure that this bill gets us to where we want to be. Hopefully, the Ways and Means will figure that out, but I'm glad that Lindsay and Phil clarified that the, and correct me if I'm wrong, clarified that those two provisions on lines 15 and 16, which even with the Dash Amendment stay in the bill, do not take the local control away from the districts to coordinate their own professional development and their information and educational technology, but that the goal of this is to have information available to other districts regarding professional development opportunities rather than take the coordination aspects away from the districts. So.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Yeah.
Senator Cruz.
Chair, Senator Bonamici, if we're taking away local control, there's no way I'd be supporting it.
Further discussion, Senator Metzger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I don't think the bill actually does anything other than pay for a state-sponsored website for $130,000. I think that professional development is very, very critical, and I think it requires a greater investment and is focused. And just adding another layer of someone and say they're doing professional development, I don't think achieves it. And so I will support going to Ways and Means for the ability to have that discussion as what does this really help professional development for teachers. I think that discussion needs to be had in that process. So I will support the motion, but as is, I would not anticipate that 2 years from now there will be any more professional development benefits for our teachers today than if we ever pass this thing in its current form and with its current support level. So, but I will be supportive of the motion.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. Just clarification for the record. The money isn't for the development of the website. The fact is that somebody's going to have to be in charge of content, and that's what the money's for. Websites don't cost that much. So,
you should see some of the websites that turned out to be where all the money went on some of the things we have passed,
well,
Senator Cruz.
Not being technologically all that smart, this is what I've been led to understand, and I believe.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, is there any objection to this motion? Seeing none, the measure will be sent as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and we have just enough time to deal with the little bill that could, Senate Bill 901, public work session on Senate Bill 901 is open, and Dana, would you give us a quick
update?
Sure,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is the Oregon Educators Benefits Board. We did receive a fiscal statement since the beginning of our hearing indicating that the fiscal impact to school districts is indeterminate and that the impact to the Oregon Educators Benefits Board would be minimal given that they already have a rulemaking process. And the statement was issued on the Dash 6s, which replaced the measure. They permit a school district that has not offered a benefit plan provided outside of OEBB, that hasn't offered plan offered by OEBB to provide a plan as they've been doing previously. It requires an actuarial analysis at least once every 2 years to receive that exception. And it prohibits employees of a district or an employee group within a district from providing or contracting for benefit plans other than those provided by OEBB once they have joined in. And this is meant to address, I'm sure Senator Bonamici would speak to, a movement between districts by employees.
Thank you. When we last left this bill, we had a legislative council opinion that said it is absolutely necessary to legislatively clarify the scope. Senator Bonamici.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's, in fact, what happened when I started looking at the comparability provisions that were in the original Senate Bill 426 and found that because of the way they were codified, they weren't going to remain in the statute, which I thought would be very problematic for districts who were relying on that. So I went through the process of working with legislative counsel to clarify that this puts the comparability provisions that were in the original bill back into the statute so that the districts that are currently not in OEB will be able to remain, if they can provide comparable benefits for less money, they'll be able to remain out of OEB. The reason we put the provision in about every 2 years getting the analysis, we originally started with 3 years, but this was a compromise, and we also put, if requested by the district or the organization, labor organization representing eligible employees. And the reason we put that provision in, again, part of a discussion, ongoing discussion and compromise, was because if a district is convinced that they need to stay out of OEB and will continue to get better benefits for their employees, but the employees are concerned that maybe perhaps OEB can give a better price on the insurance, and the employees can simply request the analysis to be done. It doesn't change whether there will be comparable benefits available. It's just that the request can come from the employees as well as from the district. I just want to reiterate that this doesn't apply to districts that are already in OEB. It's for the districts that are not currently in OEB to be able to continue to stay out if they're providing comparable benefits.
And thank you, Senator, and thank you for your dogged determination on this. It went pretty smoothly, yes, if I recall, all the way through, didn't it?
Wow, thank you. So we have
any other comments?
Dash gazillion amendment here.
Good. Senator Morris?
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I move the -6 amendment to Senate Bill 901.
Senator Morris moves the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 901. Discussion? Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did not support OEB last session. If it was up this session, I still would not support it. I like the original bill that potentially would have allowed a district to opt out at their discretion. I don't think this does that. I think at the end of the day, the granting of waivers will diminish and disappear. And I'm going to support this because at least it gives a few folks a brief moment of freedom.
Further discussion?
I would echo the Senator's comments.
If not the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 901 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 901 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, the measure passes with a due pass recommendation to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Senator Bonamici, would you like to carry it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Call it the Freedom Bill from now on.
Thank you for hanging in there, committee. If there is no other business, we are adjourned.